incredibly important, not just in antiquity, but also recently. Redfern area, it was the founding place for many of the Aboriginal controlled organisations that spread across the continent. It provided a welcoming place for a large Aboriginal community until gentrification and the rising cost of housing pushed many of the Aboriginal community out of the area. Kids growing up in this area or working in Aboriginal controlled organisations can no longer afford to live in the area, and the community has been hollowed out. Redwatch supports the Redfern Waterloo Aboriginal Affordable Housing Campaign call for a 10% Aboriginal affordable housing on all government controlled lands in Redfern Waterloo, and for an increase in Aboriginal social housing and for Aboriginal jobs and ongoing employment from the delivery of those services. So acknowledging country is not just about what's happened in the past, it's also about dealing with what's happening in this community at the present moment. I want to acknowledge some of the elected officials in the room. Kenya Plibersek, obviously, our member for Sydney, but I also noticed that Councillor Davis is here. And have I got any? Obviously, Councillor Scott, because she's on the high table. sorry about that. We have an apology from Clover Moore, but I just want to acknowledge that City of Sydney CEO Monica Baroni and council staff, including Graham Yarn, and people from the Office of Lord Mayor are in the room. And we're also joined tonight by Simon Newport, the CEO of Land and Housing Corporation, and some of his staff, and we welcome them. Looking across the room, I see public housing tenants, housing academics, representatives from community housing providers, housing advocates, and others that have a keen interest in housing policy. I acknowledge you all for your interest, commitment, and the work that you do around housing. I also need to, at the beginning, to emphasise that Redwatch is not aligned with any political party, even though tonight we have three ALP panel members. This has drawn some comment from our Greens colleagues, given that in both the Federal Senate and the New South Wales Legislative Councils, Greens, along with other crossbenchers, hold the balance of power if the government cannot get support from the Liberal and National Party, as we're seeing currently in Canberra. Over the last year, we've seen both a new federal government and a new state government, and a different approach to housing to their predecessors. Admittedly, it's not as different enough for some. What happens in Canberra and Macquarie Street has consequences for what happens in our community in sites like Elizabeth Street, Waterloo, North Eveleigh, and Explorer Street. Redwatch is holding this meeting to give people an understanding of the federal government's housing policy aspirations. While Tanya Plibersek does not have housing in her current portfolio, she's held the role in an earlier government and is well placed to tell us about what the federal government wants to do. We're also providing an opportunity for some responses and comments both from the New South Wales Housing Minister Rose Jackson and the President of the Australian Local Government Association, Linda Scott. At the end of the presentations, there will be opportunities for questions. Finally, I note that Minister Plibersek and Minister Jackson, in their day-to-day responsibilities, both have responsibility for water. Tonight, however, we want to talk about housing, unless it's about Waterloo. To start tonight's presentation, I would like to welcome our local member for Sydney, Tanya Plibersek, who is the Federal Minister for Environment and Water, and ask her to tell us about the federal government's housing policy.
Thank you. Thanks, sir. thank you so much, Jeff. And it's wonderful to be here with Councillor Linda Scott again, and wonderful to have Councillor Imelda here as well. Great to see you. And Monica Baroni from the City of Sydney, and all of you. And I'm looking forward to Rose Jackson joining us shortly. I want to start by acknowledging that we're meeting on the traditional lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and join with Jeff in acknowledging that the Redfern Waterloo area is a really special place for Indigenous Australians, because it was the heart of the Indigenous self-determination movement in the early 70s, when the medical service was established and the legal service was established. That was the beginning of a wave of self-determination style services around Australia that started here in Redfern. And I think in a year where we're deciding on constitutional recognition for First Nations Australians and a voice. It's worth remembering our special place in that history in this community. I'm going to very quickly run through some of the housing policies that we are currently proposing at the federal level or implementing at the federal level, but just to give you a moment's worth of background. As Jeff said, I was the housing minister from 2007, and I feel like I was a housing minister at an incredibly, was a terrible time because it's the GFC, but it was a very lucky time for housing policy because one of the stimulus areas that we invested in was housing. And so as housing minister, I built 21,600 public housing homes and the first 35,000 National Rental Affordability Scheme properties until Tony Abbott killed that program that was due to deliver 100,000 National Rental Affordability Scheme properties. And we did the homelessness white paper. We established about 80 new homelessness services and built places or rebuilt places like Annie Green Court up there across the road from Redfern Park for frail aged homeless people to have a place that was safe and beautiful to live in. And the Common Ground on Bridge Street in Camperdown, we were able to build facilities like that all over Australia. And I can tell you, in fact, I was just reflecting on this today with David Borger, who was the New South Wales Housing Minister at the time. He and I went to the first house that was built under the stimulus program in New South Wales. And there was a family there that had four kids, and one of the children was a 14-year-old son who had a really profound disability, physical and intellectual disability, and his mum and dad had been carrying him up and down three flights of stairs to get to their upstairs unit, and they'd been lifting him in and out of the bath to wash him. And we went to their beautiful new home, which had perfectly level access from the street, wide hallways, tiled floors, reinforced walls for the lifting equipment they needed to get their son in and out of bed, a bathroom that he could wheel his wheelchair into and be washed appropriately, and the life-changing thing for that family to be properly housed, I will never forget how you know, what a difference that made to that family's life. And then the homelessness white paper, you know, I met so many people who had been housed for the first time in years, but one that I particularly remember was in Adelaide, the new Common Ground facility we built in Adelaide. This lovely man baked a vanilla sponge for me and a group of other people who were visiting, having a look at the new Common Ground. And he said, come out here, and took me onto his balcony and pointed across the road to an old petrol station with cyclone wire around it and said, I'd slept there every night for 7 years, my new home. So it is absolutely life-changing. You don't need to convince me how life-changing it is. The Abbott government came in, they abandoned our target to halve the rate of homelessness in Australia. They destroyed the National Rental Affordability Scheme. They got rid of, you know, a bunch of the programs that we put in place. And 10 years later, we are dealing with the consequences of a decade of failed housing policy. There is a housing crisis in Australia at the moment. There's no question that we don't have enough homes for people to buy that are affordable, we don't have enough homes for people to rent that are affordable, and we don't have enough social housing dwellings. We need to fix that. So what are we doing to fix it? Well, the thing that's probably got most attention, oh, you didn't give me a time limit, sorry. Can I talk into you want me to speed up, don't you? I'll just quickly run through the housing policies. The one that's got most attention is the Housing Australia Fund. It's a $10 billion fund. The income that is generated from that will build 30,000 homes in its first 5 years. We've said we'll set aside 4,000 of those specifically for women and children escaping domestic violence. But that's not the only thing that we're doing. We've just in the most recent budget increased Commonwealth rent assistance by 15% for more than 1.1 million Australians. That's the first increase in Commonwealth rent assistance in decades. We've put another $2 billion on the table for more social and affordable housing by increasing the guaranteed liabilities of the National Housing Finance and Investment Corporation, NIFIC. So that's the organisation that community housing providers, for example, can borrow from to build more public community housing. We've increased incentives to increase the supply of rental housing. So the build-to-rent arrangements, we've slightly taxed, tweaked the tax treatment. Makes very little difference to Commonwealth tax receipts, but we'll build an extra 250,000 homes, we estimate. We've signed a new housing accord with local government and state governments with an ambition to build 1 million new well-located homes over 5 years from 2024. We're investing $350 million in additional federal funding to deliver 10,000 affordable rental homes over 5 years from 2024 as part of that accord, matched by the states and territories. We're widening the remit of the National Housing Infrastructure Facility, making it another $575 million available to invest immediately in social and affordable rental homes. We've provided $67.5 million to states and territories through the National Housing and Homelessness Agreement to help tackle homelessness for this year. That's part of the $1.6 billion extension of the National Housing and Homelessness Agreement with the states and territories as we're renegotiating the new agreement. They're usually five-year agreements. We've expanded the eligibility for the Home Guarantee Scheme, helping more people into home ownership. And I think the co-investment one, the shared equity scheme, has seen about, I think it's about 247 people in the electorate of Sydney get into shared equity. And then there's a bunch of things that we're doing in remote housing. For example, $93 million we're investing to upgrade the Mutitjulu Township, $100 million for housing of essential infrastructure in the Northern Territory homelands, $111.7 million, again with the NT, to accelerate building of new remote housing. $20.8 million to help stop the decline of Aboriginal Hostels Limited, $23.3 million for Rec Bay to upgrade the housing there. We're working with the state and territory housing ministers to develop a proposal to strengthen renters' rights. That's a start. They're the things that you probably haven't heard about because they haven't been quite as controversial as will people vote for the $10 billion Housing Australia Fund or won't they? Thanks.
A little bit quicker, so I guess I might just come back to the question and ask. I'll leave her a second. But I was just going to ask you the question as to what you thought all that was likely to mean for your electorate.
Look, I think Sydney is a real affordability challenge. It's why it's so important that we keep and increase. Hello, Rose.
Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you.
I can talk under wet cement, Rose. It won't disturb me. It's why it's so important that we keep and in fact increase the supply of affordable housing and social and community housing in this electorate. It's also like we've got enormous urban density just down the road here in Green Square, and I don't mind urban density. What really has alarmed me in recent years is the mismatch between the density going up and the lag in providing the community facilities for the new residents moving into those places. And I don't want to put Rose on the spot, but under the previous government, the state government, I wrote probably half a dozen begging letters saying, if you want to put 60,000 extra people in Green Square and Victoria Park in coming years, what are you going to do about public transport, just for a start? There's actually a metro that's going from the city that'll end up in Sydenham, and the longest stretch where there's no station is between Waterloo and Sydenham. It can go basically under where we're doing this massive urban development project, and I cannot understand why we're not putting one more station in that big stretch between Sydenham and Tempe. There's a school going in at Green Square, that's great, but you know, the people are already there and the school's still being built. I want to see good quality consolidation. I'm not actually at all opposed to more people living in my neighbourhood. I actually quite like it. I just want to make sure the facilities are there for those people.
Thank you, Tim. Next up, I'd like to welcome Rose Jackson back to the Red Watch meeting. She attended our housing policy debate with representatives from the Greens and the Liberal Party prior to the New South Wales election. Now she's a minister. She's Minister for Water and Minister for Housing, Minister for Homelessness, Minister for Mental Health, Minister for Youth and Minister for the North Coast. So she's got a lot of things that she's looking at as well as housing. We've asked Rose to comment on the federal policy and to provide us an indication of what New South Wales government might do in response to these proposals.
Great. Hi, everyone. It's nice to see many of you again. My name's Rose. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land. The New South Wales government is incredibly excited about the engagement with the federal government and our local government partners about the prospect to do more on social and affordable housing. I think, you know, the interest that the Labor government has shown in delivering social and affordable housing is an incredibly refreshing change from the approach of the previous government, who didn't even have a housing minister in the cabinet and showed no interest. So obviously we're enthusiastic about the Housing Australia Future Fund passing. We have got our team ready to go as soon as it does pass, assuming it does, to, you know, put in submissions on behalf of our state, which we are thinking will secure somewhere around 16,000 new dwellings, new affordable housing dwellings for our state over 5 years. That's not enough. It's not nearly enough to solve the housing crisis, but it's a good contribution. So that's a fantastic opportunity for us to build on that. We're really hopeful that it does pass. So all power to you, Tanya. You know, we're also just enthusiastic about the delivery of a housing and homelessness plan from the federal government, an actual strategic approach to how we are going to resolve housing and homelessness. We're very engaged in that. So, you know, I think we've always said we're not interested in blame shifting. We're interested in working together. The federal government has shown that seriousness. We're trying to show that seriousness too. But it's a big opportunity for us in New South Wales. I don't want to oversell it. You know, I've never been interested in saying, you know, the federal government's contribution alone is going to be enough to resolve the challenges we face. You know, there's no point. Like, you get enough hyperbole from politicians. There's no point pretending that that contribution alone is going to be enough. The state government is going to have to step up and do a lot more. And we're interested in doing that. But having said that, we would not be able to resolve this challenge on our own without a federal partner who was willing to put finance on the table, land on the table, options on the table. And so I think we have that.
So Linda, you know, is a City of Sydney councillor. But she's also been involved over a long period of time in the New South Wales representative body representing councils, and now she's in the federal body doing that. That actually gives her a seat at the table with the federal government and the states about what happens around issues such as housing. So I'd like Linda to give us a little bit of a response from a local government perspective.
Thanks, Jeff. I too will acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respects to elders past and present, and also my lovely colleague Imelda Davis from the City of Sydney here, as well as many people I can see from peak housing bodies, from our local community groups, as far as Glebe and Piedmont all over the place, and also, of course, to the wonderful Redfern and Waterloo community. So as Jeff says, of course, my role is to be one of your local councillors, but also as the national president of the Australian Local Government Association, to represent the nation's 537 local governments. They all agree on absolutely everything, so it's really easy. I represent councils and councillors of every political stripe in the nation, and so as you can imagine, I just want to be very transparent with you. It's quite a task to get them to work together on things that are of national importance. But I am really proud to say that we have, as Tanya indicated, signed up with the Commonwealth Government and the states and the territories to work in conjunction with all of those levels of government on this plan that the Commonwealth Government has put forward. That's a really important step because councils have a really important part to play, not only by delivering the zoning and in some jurisdictions the development decisions to deliver these houses, it's quite different depending on the different jurisdictions, but also because many councils themselves are investing in social and affordable housing through either directly building housing, through donating our own land, or through collaborating with other providers. Rose has been very polite here tonight, but I do want to call out that in the past term of the state government, the Liberal National State Government, they got rid of 7,628 public housing dwellings. Many of them were sold off right here in the city of Sydney. So we've really been on the front line of that, and that's been incredibly difficult for our communities. And much of the work that I've advocated the city of Sydney do in this area, I won't go through the torrent of motions I've moved over the many years, otherwise Monica Baroni, our CEO, will fall off there. But many of the successful projects the City of Sydney has worked on have been counteracted by the sale of the former state government of those properties, and I think we should just call that out really transparently. It makes all the work that we're doing so much harder. The other contribution ALGA has recently been asked to make is to work, we've been appointed by the National Cabinet to work with the State and Territory Planning Ministers on a program of policy reforms that can deliver more social and affordable and more housing in general, and to take that back as a proposal to the National Cabinet. So we at ALGA, along with, I hope, all the State and Territory Planning Ministers are working very hard to put together all our ideas for what might make a better set of solutions to this reform, so that we can take that to the table and hopefully get agreement from all the states and territories, and then of course deliver that back to National Cabinet. That process is happening quite quickly, so we were tasked to do that by National Cabinet within 6 months, so I'm intensively working on that now. I welcome your ideas. I'm sure many people in this room will have those ideas, but it is important, and I again want to be very transparent about this, that we don't see removing local government planning powers as part of that solution. Every day you'll read in different newspapers and different media about the need to remove local government planning powers. Every 5 years, the National Productivity Commission calls for submissions and puts out a range of suggestions about how to improve Australia's productivity. Every 5 years, one of the recommendations they make is to remove local government planning powers. Some of those things have been implemented, some of those things have not. Surprisingly, there's actually, in my view, absolutely no evidence that that supports the supply or delivery or affordability of housing. In many cases, what we've seen, unfortunately, is state governments come over the top of local governments and be slower, or indeed approve poor quality housing that, when built, is unlivable, or approve properties that just don't contribute to all the things that Tanya has just spoken about tonight to make a place livable, because they're providing contributions in kind or otherwise. So we will, let me be very transparent, this is not a secret to any of you or any local government in the land, go into those rooms strongly defending the rights of local governments to continue to make planning decisions on behalf of our communities and to continue to do all we can as part of that to make a contribution to the delivery of enough housing for Australians for the future and hopefully in conjunction with the state and federal governments some more social and affordable housing too.
Thank you, Linda. So now it's going to be your turn to ask some questions. We want you to keep those questions brief and resist the temptation to do your own speech. And I ask the speakers also to be brief in their responses. Tanya has to leave at 7 p.m. for another engagement, so we would like to get through as many questions as possible. Before I start, however, I would like to ask Rose. I know the question's out there, so I thought I'd ask it from the chair. There is sort of some sort of mixed messaging around the place about what the approach from New South Wales government's going to be around the redevelopment of public housing estates, and I'm just wondering whether you're in a position to be able to give us any clarity tonight at all about that.
I mean, I am. I mean, I imagine that you're talking specifically about Waterloo South. I mean, we can go estate by estate, but considering Tanya has to leave at 7 p.m, I'm feeling as though that's possibly going to be difficult. So in relation to Waterloo South specifically, the position that the new government has adopted is not different to the position that we had before the election, which is that the previous government's proposition in relation to that redevelopment was a bad plan and we didn't support it. Our capacity to rework that plan is limited at the moment because procurement is underway. That was a process that was commenced by the previous government and we aren't able to stop that without massive compensation to the participants in that process. And potentially we want to see what comes out of it. We don't know what's going to come out of that process. I would say I'm advised it's probably about a month away from producing an outcome based primarily on the specifications that the previous government gave to that process. That would then be our opportunity to come in and say, okay, well, we didn't support that plan. How can we turn what that has produced into something that we do support? So I completely understand people's frustration about wanting quick decisions. I want that too. But similarly, you know, we can't rush things when there are processes that were initiated. It's going to produce a result. That's our opportunity to make a good decision. There are a couple of principles that will underline that decision, and in fact, all of our estate redevelopment decisions, which is our interest is more social and affordable housing. So we will not be supporting any process going forward that does not deliver a substantial uplift in the number of social and affordable housing. Every day, I ask the Department of Communities and Justice, you know, what is happening with the waiting list? There are 100,000 people waiting for social and affordable housing. Thousands and thousands of those people are children. We know that those people are sleeping in cars, in tents, in caravans. We need more social housing. We have to deliver projects that deliver more dwellings. And the voice of people on the waiting list is a really important voice not to forget. So that is a core principle. We want more. Excellent. Another principle is we want modern homes, homes with modern amenity, not shit boxes that are too cold or mouldy or don't have disability access. So we want modern homes for people to live in, homes that deliver dignity to people. We don't want to sell government land, and we won't sell government land as part of these projects. That is not what any of these renewal projects will result in. Any tenant who is relocated as part of any redevelopment will have a right to return to the development, to the new site. So there will be an automatic guaranteed right of return to anyone who is temporarily moved as a result of redevelopment. And any relocations, temporary relocations, will occur in the local area, and we're reactivating the charter on estate renewal that was developed in 2016 by the Tenants Union and Shelter and City Futures at UNSW, which is a really good document that talks about delivering control and autonomy and agency and voice. So those are principles that apply to all potential estate redevelopments that the state government will undertake. Exactly how that plays out side by side, as I said, take a long time to go through all of that. And specifically on Waterloo South, those principles will underpin the decision that we're keen to make as soon as we can. In about a month, we will have the opportunity to look at where the proposals are up to and make, you know, some decisions about how to apply those principles to that project.
Thank you very much. Have we got the roving mic? One down the back there. White hand up. I can't see while I'm sitting down as to who it is.
Jeff Russell is the man given to me. You may call me Jeff. Question, a comment and question that is going to be posed by me.
Can we use the microphone just so that people online can also hear, please?
The question posed by me, the name given to me is Jeff Possel. You may call me Jeff. The question posed by me, and the comment, first of all, posed by me, is directed solely towards the Honourable Member of Sydney, the Minister for Water and Environment, Tania Plibersek MP, the Honourable Tania Plibersek MP. According to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, there are over 120,000 people who do not live in a secure home, in a home, a place to live, to call a place to live. Further, this, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, 2 in 3 people, that's over 15 million people in this land out of approximately 25 to 26 million people, do not have a secure home. They rent or they mortgage. So there's a simple, very simple solution to everything. There are 10 million homes, places to live. There are 9 million being used as a place to live. Why not just compulsorily acquire all the land for the state on behalf of the people, meet the needs of the people by giving everyone a place to live? Okay. In fact, there are 1 million extra places to live over and above what is required. All that is required is to compulsorily acquire all the land on behalf of the people, to meet the needs of the people and in the common.
Okay.
Why not?
Thank you for that.
Thanks so much, Jeff. I'm not in favour of compulsory acquisition of empty homes, but I do think there are things that we can look at systemically that encourage homes to be properly utilised. So, for example, different jurisdictions have different tax regimes depending on whether homes are being used, and I think at a time of crisis like this, it's fair enough to look at all sorts of options like that. I don't think compulsory acquisition is the solution, but I think smart ways of encouraging all of the buildings that we've got that could house people to be appropriately used to house people, that's worth looking at. Thanks, Jeff.
You've got another one there that you've... Maybe you can just keep the list, Natasha, as you go around.
My name is Dennis Doherty. I'm from the Hands Up Glebe Group. My question is also to Tania. In the budget, the rate of funding for extra rent went up, which was very good. And there was also funding for community housing providers. So in effect, community housing providers got a double whammy. They got, because if you live in a community house, 100% of that money that went up goes straight to the community providers. And they're getting money from individuals and they're getting money from the government. So they're getting a double whammy. And every time you mention, you always mention the word social and affordable. The word public never turns up. So has the Labor Party turned completely to the neoliberal idea of a community housing provider and forgotten about social public housing?
Thanks, Dennis. In fact, I started my comments by saying I built 21,600 new public housing dwellings. So you might have forgotten that comment. I'm very proud of the public housing that I built and renovated when I was housing minister. Not only were there the 21,000 that we over 21,000 that we built, there were about 80,000 that we repaired. You would know in Glebe there are houses sitting empty because the condition of the homes is not good enough for people to live in. That's the case all over Australia. There are houses empty because they're not good enough for people to live in, and we fixed that during the GFC with their stimulus payment as well. On community housing, I like community housing. I like public housing and I like community housing, and there's not enough of either of them. If you talk to community housing tenants, many of them will tell you that they really appreciate being with a smaller provider where they can walk into an office and speak to a human being about the problem in their home. And they don't always have that, sadly, they don't always have that experience with big public housing systems that are often statewide. It can be pretty hard to get an answer. But last week I had a building where the hot water had been out for 3 days. There was a building that housed almost entirely older people that hadn't had a hot shower in 3 days and couldn't get a phone call back or get it fixed, right? So, on the other hand, I should also say that during the lockdowns, during the worst of COVID, our public housing staff, including from head office, including people as senior as Paul Beavers, were going and knocking on doors and checking where people were okay. So no, I'm not for a minute criticising the whole system. I'm saying there is room for both. There's absolutely room for both. Just as there is room, there's room for public housing, there should be more of it. There's room for community housing, there should be more of it. There should be more intensive homelessness services, ones that specialise in frail aged homeless people, ones that have mixed tenancy like Common Ground, where you've got some people who've experienced homelessness and some people who just need affordable rental. Just as there should be more affordable housing for people to buy, just as there should be more affordable private rental accommodation. We need a system that caters to all different needs and aspirations, and I don't have a problem with community housing providers getting Commonwealth rent assistance, because anything that increases their capacity to expand, like the NIFIC funding arrangements, I'm all in favour of it, because the more of it there is, the better.
I might just use the chair's prerogative to ask the question, I think. I guess one of the things that we're just seeing at the present moment is that the NROADS funding, which only went for 10 years, is now coming out, and we're having an increased number of people having rents go up as a result of it. I'm just wondering whether that sort of an approach is still on the government's agenda, or whether or not we've learnt a lesson in terms of the long-term impact of that if you don't continue it year on year.
So the whole intention of the National Rental Affordability Scheme is that it would have been a rotating. I don't know if I'm explaining this very well, but our initial investment, as properties exited the subsidised housing pool, there'd always be more properties being built at the same time. So you'd have an expanding number. The initial plan was to build 100,000 National Rental Affordability Scheme properties to really dramatically add to housing supply, subsidised housing supply. NRAS was particularly targeted at the people in the middle. They were probably just over the cutoff for public housing, or maybe on the cutoff for public housing, but on a long waiting list. You're talking key workers living in areas where they can't otherwise afford a place to rent, as an example. I think it was a really good system and never had the opportunity to mature. And that makes me really sad, because if we'd done what we'd planned, we'd have at least 100,000 homes like that in the pool at the moment. It's not nothing, you know, it's not everything. None of these things on their own are the solution to housing supply and housing affordability, but it's not nothing to have an extra 100,000 homes. And so, I'm not the housing minister anymore. We've got fantastic Julie Collins doing the work, and she's negotiating with the states and territories and with local government, having a very important role. The next Commonwealth State Housing Agreement, we've got a year to do that. We just extended the old one, $1.6 billion extension, and all of these things need to be considered by housing ministers at a Commonwealth and state level. But I stand by that program, and I wish we were still building with it.
Hi, I'm Finola Locker, and I'm a renter in Redfern, and I'm just about to get my lease renewed, so I'm worried about a rental increase. But my question is actually for Rose Jackson. So it's been reported that last year the New South Wales Labor Conference unanimously passed a resolution committing the incoming state government to, amongst other things, introducing legislation that prohibits the privatisation of any and all public housing in New South Wales, including the outsourcing of public housing to third-party providers, legislated and enforceable commitments to expanding the amount of public housing in the inner city as a proportion of total housing stock. So my simple yes or no question to the housing minister is, do you consider the 2022 Public Housing Conference motion to be the policy of the New South Wales Labor government?
Yes, I do. And we're working on the legislative process. I mean, as I always said, I'm actually just keen to get started. And so that's kind of what we're doing. The legislative process, particularly in a minority parliament, is unfortunately slow. There's a lot of bills lining up that we're working through, including a range of rental reform that is a top priority for the government. So ending no grounds evictions, allowing pets in rentals, establishing our portable rental bond scheme. All of that work is lining up on the legislative agenda. I've always said my priority is just to get started on housing, and there's a lot that we can do without legislation. And to me, that's a key priority. Hopefully we'll have the HAF coming online in July, fingers crossed. We need to be ready to get our 16,000 homes into the HAF process. That's a huge piece of work that we're massively prioritising. We don't need legislation to do that. We need action from government. Top priority of mine. A lot of the work that we can do, just building more social housing stock, getting the maintenance contracts redone in public housing, all of that can be done without legislation, and we're doing that, and we're getting that done right now. The stuff that needs legislation, rental reform, that's top of the legislative priority list. A lot of the good stuff we can do in public housing, we're just getting on with doing it, and we're going to focus on that because that's the urgency. But we will get to legislative reform when the legislative timetable allows for that.
My name is Nori. I'm a tenant in the southwestern Waterloo, which is ground zero for the proposed demolition, which we hope wasn't going to happen because Labor said they will immediately end the sale of public housing on 14th of March. They sent out that text. Nothing about procurement. I thought procuring was something a pimp does. Labor said, if you live in public housing, Labor will protect your home. Your home will not be sold. You will not be relocated. So that was the promise made before the election. You have to explain how that plays out. My real question is to Tanya about rental assistance. Back in the old days when Alcoa was growing up in public housing, there was about 10% of housing was public housing. Now it's like 3%. So I thought the reason that the government didn't give rental assistance for people in public housing is because the federal government co-funded that. I guess they used to fund it a lot more. Are they still doing that? Is it still a rational thing? Because at the moment there seems to be an incentive for the state government to turn its public tenants into community housing tenants. That way it gets more money.
Thanks, Murray. Just to be clear, yes, Commonwealth Rent Assistance is paid for people living in community housing. The government doesn't get the money, the community housing provider does, and if they use that to build more community housing, that's great as far as I'm concerned. The co-funding of public housing, yes, is decided with each Commonwealth State housing agreement, and they're usually 5-year agreements, and as I said at the beginning, we've just extended the current Commonwealth State housing agreement by a year with a $1.6 billion extension to give time to the Commonwealth and the states to renegotiate the next Commonwealth State housing agreement. And the one that I put in place when I was the minister had a bunch of money for building more public housing and fixing public housing, but also for expanding community housing and also expanding specialist homelessness services and also doing a bunch of things that were designed to bring faster, more affordable homes online for purchase sooner. So working with local government in particular through something called the Housing Affordability Fund, different half, that was a $500 million program that did things like speed up connections to utilities so that you could get a new housing estate out of the ground sooner. You got to do it all. You got to do it all.
I'm not going to stand up because I don't want to block everybody's view. Hi, I'm Audra. I'm actually a South Australian who got stuck here during COVID, sleeping in my car in the desert outside of Broken Hill for 8 weeks. I went back over the border when they opened it and I got 300 Ks inside the border and they sent me back. I was very happy about that. Maybe not. but I've been lucky enough or unlucky enough to be homeless in 5 states in this country. I'm an intelligent woman, I am an educated woman, and I find it heartbreaking in a country that's incredibly beautiful. I have travelled around this country and I have been in parts of this country that it doesn't make sense that we are homeless. It doesn't matter whether you're Indigenous, it doesn't matter whether you're pink with polka dots or white. What seems to bother me is that no matter what government puts a policy in, it's only as good as what the next government's going to do. So there's the problem at hand right now. Tanya, I appreciate it. I mean, I'm an Adelaide girl, I know about Common Ground. And I also know that in social housing, it can come down to personalities too. I was in 1 month where I'm not a drug addict or an alcoholic and you got kicked out because you weren't those things. So what my question is because it goes to what the next government's going to do, what can you put in place to protect people?
You know, that is such a fantastic question, and it's not just a question for housing affordability. It's something that worries me about every portfolio I've had, the knowing that the good thing that you really struggle to get done can just be undone with the stroke of a pen. It helps having longer agreements, like the 5-year agreements. That's a bit of a help. It helps if you can you know, get programs really up and running and established before there's a change in government, because, you know, the Liberals, they got rid of Medibank. Remember, I know it's a little, you know, wander down history, but Labor established Medibank, and then the Fraser government got rid of Medibank, and then the Labor government came in again and introduced Medicare, and we've been able to protect Medicare because it's embedded. We had a long-term Labor government. We were able to protect it. People love it. They got used to it, and it became politically impossible to get rid of it. I think if you want a policy to last, you have to make it so that it would be political a disaster for any government to try and get rid of it. And housing affordability has to be one of those policies that we prioritise and say, any government that does what Tony Abbott did to my housing policies, getting rid of NRAS, getting rid of the homelessness targets, doing a bunch of stuff like that, there is a political consequence to doing it. I don't think they suffered any consequence, to be frank with you. They suffered no political consequence. For those who didn't hear down the back, Audra said she was the one who suffered the consequences instead, and that's absolutely dead right. Can I give you one more example? We did this really fantastic program called Better Futures Local Solutions, which was getting NGOs and government organisations in highly disadvantaged areas to work together to get people the help they needed, training, work experience into a job. Fantastically successful. I put $60,000, which is nothing in the federal budget, into that program for an evaluation at the end of the program. I wrote into the program that it would be evaluated at a certain point to see if it was successful or not. They killed the program and they killed the $60,000 for the evaluation. Like, this is not just a difference in political opinion. It is a vandalism of the things that make a difference to people's lives by a government that didn't care. That's what happened.
Hi there, John Engler from Shelter New South Wales. Thanks to all three of you. Possibly starting with Minister Plibersek, given the time. We constantly hear about how families are being failed. And I think in these places of Sydney, it shouldn't be that you feel like you've got a golden ticket to have a third bedroom. Like, it seems strange that only the wealthiest of people get to live in the inner city. We need vibrant, diverse communities. What can we do at state, federal and local level to really shift the dial for families who want to live in areas like this continuously?
Another great question. And I really take your point about more families are choosing to live in the inner city if they can afford it, and we need to have accommodation that suits families. But we also, like, my electorate has a lot of single people, and it's super hard to afford the rent at the moment if you're on your own. So I think really my answer to you is that you need planning that contemplates, you know, that really broad range of accommodation types, from you know, bed sit, one bedroom, small apartments, to, you know, three bedrooms and a park next door so your kids can have a run around. We need planning that supports all of those accommodation types. And I know that you know, I've seen some of the units that City West has got in Pyrmont, that some of the other community housing providers have built more recently, and they do try and accommodate those different individuals and family types. It's, you know, thoughtful design. It's local government's responsibility. It's the the building of.
It's a great question. You would know that the city has such diversity requirements in our planning controls currently, and of course they apply to where we have the power, consideration of public housing approvals or redevelopments, and also across the private housing landscape. It's a great case for why local governments should keep our planning powers in this space, because we do insist across the board in good planning, and that means having details like a spread of one bedroom, two bedroom, three bedroom, and in some cases more bedrooms for public and affordable housing. That's something that often developers don't like. It's more expensive to provide those houses, and in some cases it's more difficult, and often when we hear pushback about particular development applications, it's because of the kinds of conditions we put in place, like paying developer contributions or like having a number of houses that have more bedrooms than others. It's in part why developers like to sometimes go to state government to get fast-tracked approvals, because they sometimes have less conditions. And so it is important to have that proper planning process. It is important that councils do the work to understand what the national population is, what our housing targets are that flow from that, how we embed that in our planning processes to make sure that the planning processes deliver the outcomes that we need, rather than just lots and lots and lots of poor quality boxes, chick boxes, I think was the technical term that the minister used, that are totally unlivable or that only deliver for a tiny particular demographic that doesn't build a community, that doesn't build a wonderful, vibrant, interesting place to live. That's the job of councils, and that's what we're trying to do in having those planning controls with conditions in place.
I just add one thing. Some of the best housing I've seen redeveloped locally in recent times is the work that the Aboriginal Housing Company has done on the block. And if you look at the units, the different sizes, particularly the ones that are designed for families with the safe outdoor play area for kids and stuff, you can see how much sense it makes to have smaller housing providers in touch with the people who are going to live in the houses, actually designing with those families and those individuals in mind, not a specific person perhaps, but a family type or a demographic type.
Thank you very much. We've reached 7 o'clock, and Tanya needs to go to another meeting. I understand Rose will be around for a little while afterwards to answer any questions that people have. But I really would like you to join with me in thanking our guest speakers for their presentation tonight. Hopefully it's helped illuminate what might be coming in housing policy from Canberra and Macquarie Street, and what ends up in our neighbourhood, Crossbenchers Village. Minister Jackson, as I said, will be around for a little while. So thank you very much. If you've got questions that you haven't had a chance to raise, I'm happy, Red Watch is happy to take those and then pass them on to the speakers for a response. So thank you very much for coming out.
Can I just thank Red Watch for organising tonight? Can I thank all of you for attending? I think conversations like this strengthen our democracy and strengthen our community. So thank you all for coming.
Everyone.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Mike. Bye-bye. Thank you.